From Pittsburgh to Harrisburg, Uniontown to York, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the real work of crafting Pennsylvania's 2024-25 fiscal year state budget is now getting underway as legislative hearings begin. David Taylor, Rebecca Euler, and Stephen Bloom are here for a Capitol Watch roundtable discussion. And as concerns over President Joe Biden's age and infirmity gain steam, some Democrats, including Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, are waging subtle campaigns to replace him as the Democratic nominee. I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capitol Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Democrats returned to the majority in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives this past week with a win by Democrat Jim Prokobiak in a special election to fill a vacant seat in Bucks County. The district is heavily Democratic, so Prokobiak's victory was no surprise. A bit more surprising was the resignation of first-term Republican State Representative Joe Adams, who represented a district in northeastern Pennsylvania. Adams cited family concerns as his reason for retiring. That gives the Democrats a 102-100 advantage in the lower chamber. A special election will be held in conjunction with the April primary to fill Adams' seat, which leans heavily Republican. All 203 seats in the State House of Representatives are up for election this November. The general election contest between incumbent U.S. Senator Robert P. Casey Jr. and Republican David McCormick is set. The petition deadline to get on the May primary ballot passed last Tuesday. No Democrat emerged to take on Casey. Meanwhile, Republican Brandi Tomasetti from Lancaster County failed to secure enough signatures to compete with McCormick for the GOP nomination. That clears the way for a Casey-McCormick battle this fall for what will be one of the most hotly contested U.S. Senate races in the nation. Meanwhile, incumbent State Treasurer Stacey Garrity and incumbent State Auditor General Tim DeFore also have clear sailing to renomination. For Attorney General, Republicans will choose between York County District Attorney Dave Sunday and State Representative Craig Williams. Democrats will have a five-way primary for that open seat. State Representative Ryan Bizarro and Aaron McClellan will vie for the Democratic nomination for State Treasurer, while State Representative Malcolm Kenyatta and Mark Pinsley will compete for the Democratic nomination for Auditor General. All this in the upcoming April primary. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Governor Josh Shapiro has proposed a $48 billion state budget for the upcoming fiscal year. It is likely to be substantially reduced by legislative Republicans. The real work of budgeting is done in legislative hearings, which are now getting underway. Here to talk about it, our Capitol Watch crew, David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation. David?
And welcome once again to Capitol Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, your Capitol Watch All-Stars, the President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association, Rebecca Euler. Rebecca, thanks so much for being here.
It's great to be here, Dave. Thanks.
And my main man, Steve Bloom, Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, great to be with you.
Great to be with you, David. Thank you.
Well, you know, more budget nonsense going down in Harrisburg as the respective House and Senate Appropriations Committee committees get ready for the parade of hearings that'll go on. And a lot of that is, you know, sort of political kabuki theater. But for those of us who've been around for a long while, we know sort of what to look for to read between the lines. So, Steve, where do you see things as that process begins?
So as you note, Dave, the process is about 3 weeks of hearings, parallel but separate between the Senate Appropriations Committee and the House Appropriations Committee. And they will grill the secretaries of the various agencies, other informed parties with respect to the different state entities. and essentially try to get from them their justification for the governor's proposed spending in the budget address he gave a week or so ago. So this is part of the process. It, like you said, it's a bit of kabuki theater, but there's some real things going on. It's unusual in any given year that at least something newsworthy and important doesn't come out of these hearings. There will be just the right question asked and just the sort of answer given that illuminates something that somebody in power didn't really want to be brought out. So there's some merit to it. I don't want to dismiss it. There's, like you said, it's partly ritual and kabuki theater, but part of it is substantive. People do ask some hard questions and it's an opportunity to grill those in power.
And hopefully they'll demand answers, you know, that it's not just posing the question, it's the follow-up that often gets the real result.
Yeah, and like Steve said, it is really the chance to drill into the agency heads and where the legislators get to represent their constituents and ask specific questions about some of the very specific programs in those agencies too, which is where things can get sort of interesting. And having been on the opposite side of this and worked in a governmental agency and helped prep a secretary for those hearings, you want to have their hearing book ready with every little fact and figure about every one of the programs that agency has, because you don't know what question is going to come out in those hearings. So you really want to be prepared. It is an opportunity for those legislators to ask very detailed questions in some cases, and especially about the governor's proposed budget and where he sees those programs and the agencies going in the near future.
And I think important to note that the governor, of course, gets a lot of press for the budget proposal speech he gives every year.
Right.
But the real meat of creating the budget always starts in the legislative chambers. And so it's the House and Senate members of the Appropriations Committee that will actually create the contours of the first offer, the proposed actual budget to be considered by the General Assembly. And ultimately, if passed, that would go to the governor for signature or veto.
We're going to depend on our lawmakers to impose some kind of economic reality onto what the governor put forward. And I know that the listeners have heard us talk about this before, but that, you know, Pennsylvania has a structural deficit. What does that mean? It means that mandatory spending is increasing at a rate and an amount greater than the rate and amount of the natural growth in tax receipts that the Commonwealth takes in. So, like, we have this structural deficit. This is driven by our demographics. And of course, that also is driving our workforce crisis and all these things. So, like, the idea that the governor is going to take a big chunk of the surplus and the rainy day fund, which we have at the moment, really just because, you know, those are Biden bucks. That's cash that's just right off the printing press in Washington. That's not coming back. And so the governor wants to blow $3 billion of that, which, of course, would pork up the baseline, obligate future, legislatures to approve spending at that level. It all gets baked in the cake. So if we're going to prevent that from happening, this is the point in the process where that'll happen.
And you're absolutely correct, David. And you asked about, you know, what is the first big takeaway? The first big takeaway is that both House and Senate Appropriations Committees are going to question the structure of the budget, the economic structure, the fiscal structure. And the glaring problem is that while this budget that the governor proposed in his address could be pulled off and executed in the upcoming year, it's not based in any sort of recurring revenue model, so that it'll first go from being a semi-balanced budget to a deficit budget. It will start to eat into the surpluses, first the general fund surplus. It will consume that in about 2 or 3 years. Once that's consumed in that second year, it starts to consume the rainy day fund, which is supposed to be set aside for economic downturns and important economic shifts in the country.
Right.
And it will all be gone in just a few short years. And then the question is, well, how are we going to pay the bills that we've already committed to provide all these things that are very costly? How are we going to pay those bills?
Yeah.
How are they going to be paid? And then talk is going to turn into, well, we've got to raise taxes.
Well, those are some of the questions I think that the Appropriations Committee should be asking. Where is the accountability? What what result are these programs having? Because you're absolutely right, pouring more and more money into state government doesn't seem to be getting us the result that we need out of our economy and out of our workforce and out of, you know, all the things that make Pennsylvania successful, will make us successful in the future. So what kind of outcomes are we going to have? And especially if we're spending this non-recurring revenue, that, like you said, is going to be gone, and we're going to have to raise taxes to replace it. If we're not putting our current money into something that's going to grow the economy, then we're just doubling down on the problem.
Exactly. How do we improve Pennsylvania's economic performance such that we can attract and keep more of the folks who are in their productive years? How do we keep them here in Pennsylvania to be, you know, to be working, to be paying taxes, to be, you know, part of that broad base that that enables us to pay for everything else? The governor's got lots of bells and whistles and, you know, lots of, you know, shiny objects, you know, in his budget plan, but I don't see any of that stuff really addressing these fundamental questions.
And look at the biggest item that the governor has talked about, and what took up so much of the debate over last year's budget, the subject of public education, educating the children of our Commonwealth. Every year for the last at least half dozen years, additional millions and billions of dollars have been poured into the public education system. The governor proposed more in this budget. And if in fact somehow that were tied to indications that the previous billions added were helping, that would be one thing. But what we've seen is a decline in student performance. We've seen, despite the fact that there are more teachers, there are fewer children. The system is essentially becoming less and less effective. You have schools where there's some schools where even all that there's not any children that meet the proficiency levels in mathematics and other basic subjects.
Not a single kid in the entire school.
Not a single kid. And yet the answer is to pour billions and billions of dollars in. If it was, like you said, if billions of dollars would really help kids, that would change the discussion. What we've seen is not only is it not helping, the performance has been dropping. That's not the answer. We've got to make structural changes, make the kind of changes that will set free the economic forces that will make the Commonwealth prosperous.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me, Rebecca Euler from Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Steve Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation.
Well, the governor talked a lot about competing effectively with other states in his budget address, and he mentioned Ohio. He mentioned some of the surrounding states and trying to compete economically with those states. And one of the things that he's proposing to do is to take out a $500 million bond to provide economic incentives for businesses to come set up shop in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And I think that it's a good example of the type of big government program that doesn't solve the problem.
Yes.
Because I think we've talked about it a lot in the past. The types of things that we need to compete with are types of states that we're competing with, are North Carolina, Texas, Florida, those places that have less regulations, less taxes, and less government spending.
Right.
So what this does is actually go in the opposite direction of the type of competition that we need to be talking about.
I mean, Rebecca, you're absolutely right. And, you know, competitiveness needs to be the priority. But to get there, we have to have strong economic fundamentals, and that the sort of you know, sweeteners and subsidies and gift packages that the governor is talking about, those things, to the degree that they're effective at all, are only effective to seal the deal at the very end. Like, there's not enough taxpayer money in the whole Commonwealth to make up the difference in profitability between, you know, being in a high performing jurisdiction versus, you know, sad to say, being here. And so rather than looking at, like, are there things that DCED should be doing that it's not doing now? Of course. To do those things, would they need more money? Well, sure, they would. But this is not the right attitude to have. Like, we need to address the baseline costs of creating and keeping jobs in Pennsylvania. We got to benchmark Pennsylvania against the high performing states, and you know, the states that you mentioned, and also, I mean, Indiana is a great manufacturing state, not that far away. Ohio is doing a lot of good stuff, and as time goes on, I really think, I mean, my fear, I don't want this, but my belief is that, you know, we're going to see them continue to perform well and probably surpass us. The bad news is that we do all these dumb things to ourselves to get in our own way. But that also means that it's the good news that it's within our power to turn things around if we have the vision and the will.
And let's look at some of the expenditures in the budget that are doing the opposite of what you talked about, that are things that are an anchor on our performance as an economy here in Pennsylvania. And I had the opportunity this past week to speak with House Minority Appropriations Chairman Seth Grove.
Mm-hmm. From York County.
A great friend from York County and an extremely knowledgeable individual. When I was serving in the House of Representatives for one two-year term, I actually had the opportunity to sit next to Seth Grove on the House floor. Literally the most hardworking member that I encountered out of all the legislators I met. But Seth was telling me a little bit about the cost drivers in the budget. And over the last several years, approximately 84% of the entire budget in Pennsylvania is devoted to just three agencies, the Human Services Department, the Education Department, and the Corrections Department. Those three things are consuming literally 84% of the budget,
right,
and growing, and have been growing just year after year after year. They are drowning out the ability of this Commonwealth to sustain itself fiscally. And if they aren't addressed, all the other things that the governor talked about, as you called them, I forget the phrase you used.
The shiny objects. Yes.
none of that can really be done effectively if we're not going to address those cost drivers. And of those, it's human services that's the biggest, 42% of the budget. Education, the second biggest, 36% of the budget. Corrections, the prison system and the justice system, 6%.
Well, and Steve, if I may interject just for a moment, of course, the Department of Human Services is everything that deals with the federal Medicare and Medicaid programs. And one of the great dangers that is before us now in the state of New York, that that the governor there has opened up taxpayer funded benefits to illegal aliens. And so as we've seen this massive influx of unknown millions of illegal aliens, and of course, Philadelphia being a sanctuary city, that if the administration through executive action or if the General Assembly would approve extending those taxpayer-funded benefits to foreigners, that could be ruinously expensive and make a bad situation much worse.
And that's, as I said, that's the underlying risk, the underlying problem that doesn't really make headlines. It's just such a big problem is the cost of these three in particular, three agencies. Then think of all the other things that the government is expected to get involved in and do.
Right.
All those just get the leftovers. They just get the crumbs at the table. So there's got to be a rethinking involved, and there's going to have to be discipline involved. And when you look at, again, what Governor Shapiro presented, it doesn't have those things. It doesn't have spending discipline. It's not fiscally sound. It's built on spending today and not having enough to spend tomorrow.
And it's just so disappointing, Rebecca, because when he was a Montgomery County commissioner, that Josh Shapiro actually did a really great job of righting the ship and holding the line and keeping expenses down. He got the bond rating back up again. Can we have that Josh Shapiro back, please?
Zero-based budgeting, I think.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Yes.
It means that instead of walking into the room at these appropriations hearings with an already large budget and asking for more, imagine if each agency head came into those meetings starting from zero with an expectation that if they want anything to be funded, they've got to justify it and prove that it's been effective. What a game changer that would be. And it's not an imaginary thing. It was done in Josh Shapiro's county when he was county commissioner.
Yes.
They did it successfully.
The accountability that we were talking about, that's where that comes in, because you make them, the agency executives and the governor, prove that that program is worth staying in the budget. These are the impacts that we've been able to make with this program, so it deserves to be there.
Well, it's a change in the way of thinking, and oftentimes that's the most difficult change of all. How do you change your mindset? How do you look on things with fresh eyes. But certainly, it's the old cliche, the definition of madness is doing the same thing again and again and expecting a different result. You've seen Pennsylvania underperform economically year after year, decade after decade, that we don't grow as fast as other states in the country. Therefore, we don't gain population at the same rate. And this is why Pennsylvania continues to, lose another member in the U.S. House delegation every census. And the only way to turn that around is to fix things in Harrisburg.
And we talk about that a lot on this program, but we're not the only ones talking about it. It's no secret. It's not a surprise. We've seen it unfold, and scholars, anyone who pays attention to Pennsylvania politics and the operation of the legislature and the way the governor interacts with the legislature, everyone sees it. We are making the same mistakes over and over again and depriving ourselves of the ability to compete, thereby driving this cycle of decline rather than a cycle of getting stronger and better.
Yeah. And I just wish we had gubernatorial leadership on these kinds of issues, that if we had a pro-growth governor who could lead the way and explain to the public why fiscal restraint is critical, why we need to rethink all of these different state agencies and state programs and the way that we've done stuff, that would make – it wouldn't make it an easy lift, but it would make it politically easier. So anyway, that's not going to happen for the next couple of years. So until then, we're going to, deal with things as they are. And hopefully, as was said, that we'll have a good appropriations process in both chambers and that we'll get questions from the members that will illuminate the situation and hopefully reveal more in the coming weeks as things go on. Thanks for being with us. We're coming down to the final moments of our program. And Rebecca, where can people go to learn more about you and your organization and the things that you do?
Sure. They can find the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association at PMTA.org.
That's awesome. Steve, where can people go to learn more about you?
They can visit CommonwealthFoundation.org.
Outstanding. And as ever, you can find me online at PAManufacturers.org. And from Steve and Rebecca and me, thanks so much for listening. We will catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. In the nation's capital and under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg last week, two seemingly unrelated events provide a window into both the public and behind-the-scenes maneuvering to become this year's Democratic nominee for President of the United States. At first glance, it would appear incumbent President Joe Biden has sewed up his party's nomination. But his frail and gaffe-prone appearances have made party power brokers nervous. The report released last week by Robert K. Herr, the special prosecutor investigating Biden's retention of classified documents at his Washington office and Delaware garage, triggered a nervous breakdown. The good news for Biden is that Herr declined to file charges. But then the wheels came off the president's wagon. The New York Times, not noted for right-wing leanings, blared the sub-headline, "The inquiry found that the president had willfully retained material after finishing his term as vice president and had shared sensitive information with a ghostwriter." That would seemingly presage an indictment. The decision to not prosecute rested on Herr's conclusion that he could not get a conviction because, quote, "Mr. Biden would likely present himself to a jury, as he did during our interview with him, as a sympathetic, well-meaning, elderly man with a poor memory." Herr went on to detail how the president was unable to recall key dates, including the years in which he served as vice president. Biden himself added fuel to the fire by holding a rare primetime White House news conference in which he angrily denounced the report and then committed another gaffe, confusing the presidents of Egypt and Mexico. He again appeared frail and confused while trying to convince the nation that he is not frail and confused. Polling shows a large majority of Americans, 78% in the most recent Reuters poll, say he is too old to serve a second term, and 71% of Democrats agreed. Biden's age and ongoing very public mental and physical decline were a major problem for Democrats prior to Herr's report. The issue has now taken center stage, casting some doubt on the inevitability of his renomination. If not Biden, then who? Vice President Kamala Harris has even higher negative ratings than Biden and has no signature accomplishments during her 3 years in office. The one major portfolio delegated to her was to address the border crisis, a task at which she has utterly failed. Add in her own proclivity for word salads and odd laughing outbursts, she does not present herself as a viable option. With Biden running for re-election, the Democrats have been unable to develop much of a bench. Overt maneuvering for the nomination is unseemly. California Governor Gavin Newsom, frequently mentioned as a stand-in for Biden, has appeared overly ambitious and harmed his chances in the process. The more subtle campaigns are being waged by several of the nation's governors. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer pops up on most lists of alternatives, but two relatively new governors are quietly posturing, Maryland Governor Wes Moore and Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, which connects the dots to what happened in Harrisburg last week. Governor Shapiro delivered his annual budget address to a joint session of the General Assembly. His budget proposals were peppered with spending ideas designed to appeal to each segment of the party's left-wing base. In recent years, Senate Republicans have successfully built a substantial rainy day fund to insulate taxpayers against future tax increases. Shapiro and House Democrats eye that fund like a hungry dog who sees an unattended ham sandwich on the kitchen counter. They want to pour more money into everything from the state's underperforming K-12 education system to inefficient mass transit systems. Generally, gubernatorial budget addresses are more about messaging than actual budgeting. Former Governor Tom Wolf, in his first budget address, proposed more new spending than all of his 49 counterpart governors combined. That, of course, never happened, but each year he continued to advocate for higher spending. Shapiro was not as unrealistic as was Wolf, but his $48.3 billion proposal would result in an 8.4% increase in state spending, higher than even the high rate of national inflation itself triggered by profligate deficit spending. Shapiro's budget was dead on arrival in the legislature. State Senate President Pro Tem Kim Ward described it as filled with, quote, rainbows and unicorns. Most of that proposed spending will not happen, but Shapiro will get credit for trying, and that is his goal. Pundits expect Shapiro to run for president in 2028, but he is cleverly positioning himself for a spot on the national ticket this year if Biden is forced to step aside. However subtle, the race to succeed Joe Biden as the Democratic standard bearer is now underway. With a town hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is coming up April 4th through 6th at the Penn Harris Hotel and Convention Center near Harrisburg. This year's featured dinner speaker will be Judge Jeanine Pirro of Fox News The Five. She will be joined by a wide range of state and national speakers and panelists, including Dr. Kevin Roberts. He is president of the Heritage Foundation and Heritage Action. The three-day event will also include an expanded schedule of workshops. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is the nation's largest and longest-running of the state-based conservative activist conferences in the nation. This is the 35th year. Get complete details and register for this year's Pennsylvania Leadership Conference at paleadershipconference.org. That's paleadershipconference.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.